Welcome to Wine for Normal People, the podcast for people who like wine, but not the snobbery that goes with it. I'm your host, Elizabeth Schneider, author of the Wine for Normal People book and certified wine dork. This podcast is sponsored by Wine Access. Guess what? Wine club discount available to anyone who's not currently a member. Join the club and get $25 off your first two shipments by visiting wineaccess.com/normal. The discount's applied when your order is placed. That's $125 per shipment for six bottles. So many perks of being a wine club member. Get on it today. Listen in the middle of the show for more details. Because it is Earth Day today, I decided to do a re-release of a show with probably one of the greenest, most environmentally oriented people in the wine industry in the whole world, not just in the United States, and that is Jason Haas, who's a partner and general manager of Tablas Creek Vineyard in Paso Robles. Just to remind you, his late father, Robert Haas, was a renowned importer who partnered with Chateau de Beaucastel in Chateauneuf-du-Pape to scout a perfect site to grow Rhone varieties in California. And they found it in the Adelaide district of Paso Robles and built one of the best wineries in California. Jason has become a really essential member of the wine community. He speaks all over, especially about his passion for sustainable, earth-friendly solutions in the wine industry. He's a pioneer of the Regenerative Organic Viticulture Program in California, which we will discuss in the show. He's the first premium winery in California to put his wine in the sustainable 3-liter bag and box. And this particular show was Jason's third appearance. This time he updated us on all the work that he and Tablas Creek did to push forward making their vineyard and winery gentler on the environment. It is a great one for Earth Day to listen to the whole approach, not just one part, not just the vineyard, not just biodynamics or regenerative or organics. We talk about everything from packaging to shipping to all of the things that would be important if you were coming up with an entire solution to make the wine industry more sustainable. Jason is a fantastic guest. He's funny, he is witty, and he is so intelligent. I know you will enjoy this rebroadcast of the show, which is perfect for Earth Day. So let's get to the show. Jason, welcome. You have taken a huge role in addressing climate change. Can you talk about the differences in organic, biodynamic, and regenerative farming and just explain to us why you're doing regenerative farming versus biodynamic and organic?
I'll sort of take you on our journey because I think as we have moved from one of these stages to the next, it's come as we've come to understand what the strengths are of what we were doing, but also what their shortcomings were. So we started out farming organically. We've been doing that since our inception. It's something that we inherit from our partners at Beaucastel. They've been fully organic since the 1950s. And they made that change because they felt like it was the best way that they could come up with to amplify the character of their place. And I think we still think about that as an overriding reason to do the things that we do, is that the less that you put onto a vineyard from the outside, the more it's going to taste like itself, the more it's going to taste like the place that was always there. And I think that's intuitive for people, that the less you put on, the more it's going to taste like itself.
Right.
So, but we realized that organic is a pretty limited way to think about something like that, because it's largely concerned with the replacement of chemical inputs with non-chemical inputs. And that's a good thing. It's good to take chemical fertilizer, petrochemical fertilizer out of the equation and replace it with organic fertilizer or compost. This is a positive change.
I have a question about that because I read this thing from the California Sustainable Wine Growing Alliance, and they were talking about how issues in the vineyards, nitrogen is a major problem in terms of output. Some of it is just from the grapes, but some of it is from fertilizer. It's an old report, but they're evaluating, and we're going to talk about it later because we'll talk about the biggest problem in wine in terms of sustainability, which is clearly packaging and transport. But what they were saying is that one of the big problems is nitrogen. Now, some of that is just, it comes out of the plants, but organics does help with that, right?
Sure, absolutely. And it helps with that in a number of different ways. I mean, there's a huge footprint for the creation of chemical fertilizers also, from the extraction and the creation piece. And then you're putting usually a specific and intensive nutrient on a vineyard, but you're missing all the links in the chain that would normally create that naturally. And so as it breaks down, it tends to break down with some unintended consequences.
Yeah.
So still, I think it's a very good thing to replace chemicals with non-chemical alternatives. But we decided that if our goal was amplifying the character of place that we're showing in our wines, it would be even better to create our own fertility, say, with our own weeds on our own property rather than bring in organic fertilizer from the outside. So that led us to getting our first dozen sheep, which are now up to 350 sheep every year. And those graze through our vineyard, eat our cover crops, turn the cover crops into manure, end up putting a ton of manure per acre per year, just that they spread themselves. That felt to us like a much more coherent and natural way of getting what we needed, getting the fertility that we needed.
How do you manage 350 sheep?
We hired a shepherd.
Oh, you so did not.
We totally did. We have a shepherd on staff who designs a rotational grazing plan. So they move from block to block. We move them every 24 to 48 hours because we don't ever want them to overgraze an area. We want them to eat evenly and to spread their manure evenly. And you have to have a plan for that. And what happens is you move them out of an area, and then you allow the grass in that block to regrow. And then a couple of months later, it's regrown enough that you can move them back into that area. So you get multiple passes, and that simulates essentially a grassland environment, which would normally have herds of grazing animals on it. It allows you to build fertility and build carbon content in your soil in a really dramatic way. And then in the summers, when we can't have them in the vineyard, because they would happily eat the leaves and the fruit, we use them to graze a fire perimeter in our forests. So
wow.
We have them out, we use them in our own forest lands, but we also have arrangements with our neighbors where they go out and they'll browse down the grasses and the shrubs and the dead leaves and all of that are on the forest floor. They help regenerate the forests and they reduce our fire risk, because that fuel load is a big thing which makes the wildfires so dangerous here in California.
Napa needs to get on that, huh? I mean, that's a great idea for taking care of that naturally, as opposed to going in and clear cutting and doing whatever they have to do or of course having fires and then having the forest regenerate itself. That's a really great idea.
It makes a ton of sense, yeah. I think. And a lot of the idea behind regenerative farming is look at the natural systems and figure out a way that you can implement something close to that in a modern farm environment. I mean, we can't have grazing herds of elk wandering through the vineyard the way that you would have had in a natural California forest landscape 200 years ago. I mean, obviously, they'd be super destructive. And there aren't the herds of elk anymore. They've been hunted and fences have gone up. And like, it's just not the same thing. At the same time, an ecosystem without an animal piece to it is not a balanced ecosystem. It's just not the way that it would work in the natural world. And so a lot of the problems that have come in terms of things like making sure that you have ongoing fertility, making sure that you don't have competition from plants you don't want, and making sure that you have good water retention, those things get solved or at least moved in the right direction in a significant way by the re-implementation of animals into a farm ecosystem. And so we just need to figure out a way to do it that works for the annual cycle of grapevines, which means an intensive input of animal activity in the winter when the vines are dormant. And then in the summer, figure out something positive that we can do with those animals for the 6 months they can't be in the vineyard. So it's always this 6 months, get them in every vineyard block three times. And then in the summer, get them into the forest and let them do their work out there.
It's got to be a huge amount of management, but it sounds to me like there needs to be more of that going on elsewhere, maybe farther north of you, where it doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of that going on. It seems like in the North Coast, you don't see a lot of animals or grazing. Occasionally you do see it, but there isn't a ton of that going on. Do you think it's just for cost? People don't know about it. Why do people not include animals in the equation?
I think it's the kind of thing that could change pretty fast. I think mostly you don't see it because it's just not the way that it's been done for the last 30, 40, 50 years. Right. It still feels new. But I know the level of interest that we've seen down here just in Paso, we've gone from being the only vineyard that had sheep in it to now there's probably 20 that have sheep in them in the winter. And that's happened in 5 years. I think you can see it change pretty quickly. but it requires somebody to manage it. It requires somebody with a certain amount of experience with livestock, which, I mean, generally viticulturists are not trained on livestock.
No, but they're in agricultural areas. So there are people likely around adjacent who have that experience, right? I mean, how hard was it to find a shepherd?
Well, the shepherd sort of initially sort of dropped into our laps, the first shepherd who we hired, because he was running a ranch just down the road from us that did cattle ranching and also had some vineyards. So he had some vineyard experience and he'd been used to running cattle and sheep. And he was excited about the regenerative aspect of what we do because he'd gotten himself trained by the Savory Institute, which does a lot of really wonderful work in terms of coming up with rotational grazing systems that help build soil fertility and build soil microbiome. And he was excited to apply what he was doing at a place that was really kind of philosophically aligned with trying to use our vineyard and use our farming capabilities to farm in a regenerative way.
That's amazing.
It's not like there is a huge shepherd network that like when you need a shepherd, just like 1-800-SHEPHERD. It's like, it's the kind of thing which there's not really formal training for. So it's all sort of apprenticeship. So it builds fairly slowly. A lot of the center of it is happening up around Piscinas Ranch, where Kelly Mulville has been doing some really amazing work with kind of the science behind grazing animals, integrating them in vineyards. And I think that's going to end up being a hub, which is really important for it, but it has to grow little by little because it's like, this
where is she located? She's in Paso?
No, he's up north. He's up in the northern part of the Central Valley.
Oh, okay. So that's exciting to hear. So regenerative is a certification? It's a what?
So regenerative, small r, is an idea like sustainability. Regenerative organic certification is a certification program that kind of puts the regenerative practices into a framework and then certifies that you're doing all of the pieces. So let me take you through our own progression as to how we got there. So we had been farming organically. We decided we wanted to look at something more holistic. And so started implementing sheep in the vineyard, started following more and more of the biodynamic protocols, integrating more biodiversity, planting fruit trees every 100 or so vines that we would plant, leaving sections with beneficial insect habitat, native vegetation. And that eventually led us to getting our biodynamic certification, even though I think it's fair to say that we have always been skeptical about the more mysticism, astrological parts of biodynamics. And then when we got a call in 2018 asking us if we would be interested in joining the pilot program for a new certification that was called Regenerative Organic Certified, we dove into that and realized that it sort of checked all of our boxes and addressed what we felt like were some of the shortcomings of both organic and biodynamic. So organic is really quite rigorous, but it's very narrow. It basically is a list of things you can't do. You can't use chemicals for fertilization or pest control or weed control. And if you don't use any of those prohibited things and you go through a certification, you can be organic. But it says nothing about your use of resources. You could be flood irrigating a water-intensive crop in the desert. And as long as you aren't using chemicals, you can be organic.
That's incredible.
I mean, again, it's rigorous as to what it does. It's looking at a very narrow slice of what great farming is. So we felt like a more holistic biodynamic approach made a lot of sense because it was a positive way of looking at building an ecosystem that was in balance. When we were approached to be a part of this regenerative organic certification, it seemed to us like it had that holistic approach of biodynamics, but it subtracted the astrological piece of it, which, and for people who aren't super familiar with biodynamics, it was written by an Austrian philosopher more than 100 years ago. And it talks a lot about things like activating cosmic energies by adding this particular concoction at this particular time. And as we've learned more about the science behind it, there's usually good scientific basis for why you're supposed to add this particular thing at this particular point in the growing cycle. But it's not because it's activating its cosmic energies. It's because, well, let's use an example. So there's a silica prep. You're supposed to grind up quartz and spray it, dilute it in water and spray it on the leaves of your vines as you get towards the second half of your growing season. And it's supposed to, again, like refract the sun's rays in a particular way and activate energies. And it thought that, like, that's not why it works. It works because silica is a micronutrient that grapevines need to photosynthesize optimally and tends to be in short supply as you get later in the growing season. So it
what
works.
What about the cow horn? That's what,
well, same
know,
thing.
Everybody, I mean, like, right, all the pictures are about the cow horn. Does the cow right. horn make sense?
Well, certainly having compost. So that's basically, you're supposed to do a couple of things with a cow horn. You're basically supposed to put a prep in the cow horn and then bury it in the soil for a certain number of lunar cycles. And sometimes this is manure. Sometimes this is a plant extraction. Sometimes this is a mineral extraction.
Yarrow, whatever. Yarrow root, right? Yeah, yeah.
Again, if you know the science behind it, it's much better to allow, say, manure to break down in the soil for a certain amount of time before you then apply it to your farm. So what you're doing is you're essentially giving it time to evolve into something that is more easily absorbed and less likely to carry other negative impacts. Does it matter that it's in a cow horn as opposed to some other vessel?
Right.
No, I don't think it does. Does it matter that it's 3 lunar cycles as opposed to 45 days or 60 days? No, I don't think it does. I remember listening to John Williams from Frog's Leap speak at an event that we were both at a dozen years ago. And his take was that the cow horns were a total distraction. It was what people focused on, but it was not at all why biodynamics was important or why it worked. And the specifics of it, people got hung up on the specifics of it as opposed to the generalities of apply good natural materials at the right times and eliminate chemicals so that your vines can make sense of their environment and regulate themselves in a more normal way.
Well, this is part of the problem with the wine press is that, and all press really, they go for the thing that is the most extreme or rare as opposed to the broader picture, which is this is really good for vines. It's really good for farming. It will be better for the earth. Instead, they're saying lunar cycles and sap flowing up during the tides and the cow horns, because they can take pictures of that. If you Google biodynamics, if you like look up the image, every image is a cow horn, every image, or the Demeter certification, but every image is a cow horn. When I read some of the stuff, it's like, this is kind of sensationalized. Even in wine, we get some things that are like, you miss the point completely.
Yeah. And honestly, it's hard to blame people. Like if you read the actual biodynamic writings, I'll read it and just be like, you've got to be kidding. Like, how could anybody have thought that this was a serious approach to farming? But the thing is, it works. So figuring out why it works is important. And that's one of the things that we love about this regenerative organic certification is that it essentially breaks down those biodynamic soil farming protocols and lays the science down behind it. So you are doing things that allow the microorganisms in the soil to thrive. That creates links in essentially the food chain, the nutrient chain in your soil, which allows the soil to break down organic matter more effectively. If you also reduce tillage, which is one of the things of regenerative farming, it then allows these larger and larger networks, the roots that are growing underground and all of the other symbiotic microorganisms that live with them, to grow to more denser and denser colonies, which increases the organic matter in your soil. It increases your soil's water holding capacity, and it gives you the ability to allow your crop, whatever that is, to pull what it needs from its natural environment, as opposed to you having to continue to add inputs from the outside because the environment itself has been stripped of its diversity and its ability to create those raw materials.
Right. You're saying the same thing that I had you listen to the agroforestry podcast with Jean-Baptiste Cordonnier, and it's the same exact philosophy. Did you watch that movie on Netflix, Fantastic Fungi, by the way?
I did not. It sounds great.
You should watch it. I think you'd really like it. A lot of it is about magic mushrooms, but a lot of it is about the fungus internet. It's pretty interesting. Okay, we've talked about dry farming, and I want to ask you about that. You do a lot of this, and there's such a bad drought in Europe, and especially California, obviously. So people are adapting. Water is a big wild card in terms of viability. So if you can't dry farm, what is going to happen to this part of climate change? Can this be solved with any of the stuff that you're working on? you do so much of it, but you're in a very particular area where you can do that because you get some rain, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's important to remember that there was no systemic irrigation of vineyards in California before the 1970s.
But we've also expanded incredibly the vineyard size.
Sure. And where vineyards are planted has expanded also.
Right.
But
so are some of those going to have to go away because they can't sustain the land, I guess is my question.
I think that's likely. Or at the very least, how they're farmed is going to have to change. But I know one of the things that we've done in order to plant dry farm vineyard blocks is we've spaced the vines further apart. So if you look at the old California plantings, they're at like, whatever, 500-ish vines per acre. And then there's been this move towards denser and denser plantings, which I understand philosophically what people are going for. You plant the vines closer together, you create more competition, you reduce the amount of crop per vine, you end up with generally more intense fruit and also overall higher yields. But in a climate like this, you shouldn't be looking at the vine density that people are used to in a place like Burgundy. I mean, in Burgundy, the problem is that there's too much water too much of the time.
Right.
And every vine you stick in the ground is a wick that helps pull moisture out of the ground and helps regulate the amount of water that's there, because you don't want too much water sitting around the roots of the vine. So 3,000 vines an acre might make a ton of sense in Burgundy. They don't plant like that in Priorat. I mean,
Spain is, their planting density is ridiculously, they have more land under vine, but fewer vineyards than many other places because they're not allowed to irrigate in a lot of these places. So they're spread out. That's how you do it.
So, I mean, those are the models that I think are relevant for what we're thinking about in California. And so our initial plantings, when we started back in 89, we were trying to set up with the same vine density as they have at Bocastel. So that's like roughly 1,800 vines an acre. And we've realized that if we want to be able to dry farm here, we need to be planting less densely. So depending on the topography, we're now planting at anywhere from 350 to 650 vines an acre, which is very, very much in keeping with what the old California dry farm vineyards in our area are. And we know it can be done. I mean, there are 100-year-old vineyards in Paso Robles that have never been irrigated. So we know it's possible, but is it possible to do that and plant close together and get 6 tons an acre? Probably not. The reward is that the fruit off of those blocks is incredible. The vines are going to be exceptionally long-lived. And that's enough to live with the fact that we're probably not going to get more than 2 or 2.5 tons an acre off of those blocks. We can live with that.
I think people in other parts of California have to come to this realization that Mother Nature is going to win no matter what. So you can either adapt to it or you're going to have to find something else to do. One of the challenges that not just wine, but all farming is going to have to deal with is that you can't stop what's going on. You can only adapt to it. I mean, Mother Nature wins every time. Can't beat it.
You delay it, but that's about it.
Yeah.
And I do think that a lot of the farming approaches that we're taking, I mean, these are things that will be a hedge against climate change. So working intensively on trying to get as much organic content, carbon content in your soil as possible dramatically increases the soil's water holding capacity. We know that we're looking at a future that's going to be drier than our past has been, then we should be doing everything we can to make sure that the soil that we have is able to hold that water that we do get. I know when we first sent in soil samples to the lab is at Cornell that does the analysis for the regenerative organic certification. We sent the soils in and got a call saying, are these really from California? Because it was like 4 or 5% organic matter in the soil. And most of California is like 1%.
Oh, wow.
And we're like, yeah, of course. You're like, yeah, you want pictures? Like, we'll show you us digging these soil samples. But it was one of the really dramatic proofs of concept for us that the things that we'd been doing are having a really measurable impact on the growing conditions for our grapevines.
It shows in the wine quality because the wine is just spectacular. You know, I love your wine so much. Someone just recently told me that they were looking for a Cunoise and they sought yours out because you're like one of the only people in the world that makes a single Cunoise. I cannot remember. I'll try to forget. Oh, no, you know what it was? It was somebody in Australia. It was Langmel in Australia. They sought out your wine because they were like, we don't even know what Cunoise would do. We don't know what it would taste like. It's always blended in. And you were the only ones. This is so interesting. Another question about, sorry, I always ask you all these really detailed questions, but you have so much knowledge about this. All right. So one thing I've also heard a lot of people focused on is energy efficiency, which I know is part of the regenerative concept. I'm hearing more and more around the world, people being obsessed with like gas powered tractors and their trucks for the vineyards on the roads, like switching to electric vehicles and things like that. Is that a big deal? Is that something that has to change? It seems like people are obsessing over electric tractors. That seems to be a big deal. And also, of course, your trucks and things that you need to bring on the road. But
I think it's valuable at the margins, but I don't think it's the thing which is going to really move the needle. I mean, yeah, we moved to entirely electric forklifts that we use and electric quads that we use to get around the vineyard. It's all powered by the solar panels that we have. We're 100% solar powered. I think that's what the future of transportation more broadly has to look like. It has to be a much higher percentage of battery powered vehicles powered by renewable energy. I mean, we know that transport is a big piece of the picture in terms of climate change. But I think for vineyard, that's not anywhere near the largest source of emissions or problems. It's not something that people shouldn't address, but I don't know that it wouldn't be my top of the priority list.
I hope you're enjoying this rebroadcast of the show. I gotta tell you, this new wine club discount from Wine Access is amazing. You're gonna go to wineaccess.com/normal. If you have not joined the wine club, here is your chance. Join the club right now and you get $25 off your first two shipments by visiting wineaccess.com/normal. The discount is applied when you place the order. That means $125 per shipment for 6 bottles, hand-selected by me and the Wine Access team. Trust me, we spend a lot of time curating this and making sure that the wines are outstanding. What a deal. $125 for 6 bottles for the first 2 months. After that, it's $150 per shipment. And there's so many other perks of becoming a wine club member. You get 10% off all other Wine Access purchases. And since every club shipment ships for free, you can get 6 additional bottles to your order with the shipping included. Shipments go out quarterly. The next one's going to focus on wines off the beaten path. There's going to be amazing stuff. There is an Armenia Novoskat. There's a Tempranillo from the Umpqua Valley in Oregon. We really stretched ourselves to get this group of wines. As always, they want you to love every bottle. So if you don't like the wine, they will credit that bottle. Take advantage of this now. If you're thinking about joining the Wine Access Wine for Normal People Wine Club, now is the time. Get this $25 off the first 2 shipments by going to wineaccess.com/normal. This is a limited time offer, so make sure that you do it today. Also, some of you have been emailing me and asking me, where are all of the old episodes? They are now on Patreon. They live on Patreon. If you would like access to those, you need to become a member of Patreon. That is now a perk of Patreon. Go to patreon.com/wineforNormalPeople. I think you will be pleasantly surprised at how much great stuff is on Patreon. If you need an incentive to join, just know that all of the back episodes are available to all patrons and they are all categorized. It's so fantastic. Having the episodes on Patreon allows me to organize them better, for you to search for them better. It's a really great solution. You will love it when you join. Also, wineforNormalPeople.com/classes. Volcanic Wines is May 11th. Then we have Off the Beaten Path French Wines, followed by Riesling and then Rosé. They are all up now. If you are looking to increase your wine education and have a great time on a Saturday night, make sure you sign up. $30 per person, and you get a discount if you're a patron. wineforNormalPeople.com/classes. Now let's get back to this awesome re-release on all things holistic and regenerative with Jason Haas to celebrate Earth Day. So let's talk about the biggest problems, which are packaging waste and transport. Can you talk about your initiative to move into alternative forms of packaging, especially box, which has blew your mind, right? I mean, your posts on box, everybody's been following what you've been doing in terms of moving Patelin de Tablas into box and it being hugely successful. People are ready for this. Consumers are kind of ahead of the industry, aren't they?
I think that's absolutely true. So, I mean, our interest in alternative packaging, it goes back longer than just this year's work on boxes. I mean, we have, for the last dozen years, we've always sold a chunk of the Patelin de Tablas wine that we sell around the country because its main goal is to go out to restaurants and wine bars to pour by the glass. we've sold about a quarter of our production on average in these refillable, reusable stainless steel kegs. So restaurants can buy them and hook them up to their tap systems and pour wine by the glass or by carafe. And then once the keg is empty, it gets returned to the distributor, and then a truck comes back to California and it gets sterilized and cleaned and refilled. So we love the idea that it's possible to sell wine without any packaging waste, because ultimately the packaging, it's a temporary holder for this thing, which is going from our tanks in our winery to somebody's glass. And we've done a lot of thinking about how do we make our bottles lighter weight and lower impact. But one of the things, and I don't know if it's in that same California Sustainable Wine Growers Alliance report that you were mentioning earlier, but they did a pretty comprehensive look at what the carbon footprint was of California wine. And it showed that packaging as a whole was more than half of the carbon footprint of the California wine. And the glass bottle itself was by far the largest piece of that.
Because making glass is incredibly resource intensive, and it also creates a lot of pollution.
Yeah, I mean, glass needs to be heated to very high temperatures in order for it to be melted and molded. And then the result is heavy. That takes a lot of energy to ship around.
Right.
And so one of the things that was a take home for me is that doing nothing else, moving to lightweight glass from normal glass reduces the carbon footprint of your total operation by about 10%.
That's great.
By the same token, moving to heavy, like using heavy glass, increases your carbon footprint by about 10%. I'm proud that we've been using lightweight bottles for a dozen years. I think the feedback that we've gotten from that has been tremendously positive and has encouraged us to think in other ways about how we further reduce that packaging footprint. And I did a carbon footprint self-analysis using that California Sustainable Wine Growers Alliance thing last summer and posted it on our blog. And I included this graph that's in the report, which showed that carbon footprint of regular glass, heavy glass, lightweight glass. And then it had a fourth column for the 3-liter bag-in-box, which reduces the carbon footprint of your wine, big picture, by 40%. And reduces the carbon footprint of your package by 84%. So it was just a line and a graph, but I kind of dismissed it as a viable possibility for us as Tablas Creek, because
your premium.
You look at what's out in the market. The most expensive boxes of wine are like $35.
And they're gross. It's gross.
A lot of them are gross.
Yeah, I mean, actually, almost all of them are gross. It's a sad state of affairs because it's a great closure, right? We all know, everybody in the industry knows, the bag and box is the best way to keep wine fresh, but nobody
right
wants
over the
to use
short
it.
To over the short to medium term. So
right. No, I mean, you need air for ageable wines, but I mean, I'm talking about just, you know, most wines are 3 to 5 years and then they're done. So yeah, a box is a great
and something like what package. 90 plus percent of wine that's bought in the United States is consumed within 48 hours. I mean, it's like you're not talking about people cellaring stuff for decades. But it didn't seem like something that was really viable because it was so far out of the range of what we were doing. And I got a comment from a friend of mine on my Facebook page when I shared this blog saying, hey, Jason, somebody needs to start to chip away at this stigma. And like, don't you think you could be the one to do it?
Right.
I spent a lot of time thinking about that comment and decided that he was right. And that somebody's got to be the first to take a crack at something. And we have, in a lot of ways, a really good platform to do this because we have direct contact with a lot of customers. We got 40,000 people on our mailing list. We've got 11,000 wine club members. We have 25,000 followers on Instagram and a similar number on Facebook. And it's like we have
a really loyal following. Also, your wines are so consistent and so good. People also know you as you, because you've done a really good job of putting yourself forth as sort of the face of Tablas Creek, because your writing is so good and you do such a great job of explaining what you're doing, that you as an ambassador, as long as you explain all of the decisions that you make, people are totally willing to go along with it. So I think your friend was right. I'm not sure, apart from maybe someone like Randall Graham, who's already done this in the past, but then, you know, he sort of folded his enterprise. There's really not very many people who are trustworthy enough to do this, because you're also, you'd never come across as somebody who's like in it for the money or trying to perpetuate some BS image. You're in Paso. I think that helps a lot too. You're not in Napa. It's much more approachable for people. They like it. They feel more welcome. And so the decisions that you make, I think can be trusted. And I mean, you can't say that, but I can. So I just did.
Well, thank you. I mean, I do think that we're used to having to bring people behind the curtain of our decisions. Because when we started, I realized pretty early that we had a bunch of strikes against us. We were making blends that didn't have a category in the market from grapes that people didn't know and couldn't pronounce from a part of California they hadn't heard of with French names that didn't mean anything to them. So like, if we couldn't get people past that and into our own world and our own decision-making, it was going to be a really uphill battle. So that dictated a lot of the choices that we've made in terms of marketing through education, communicating with people over our blog and over social media and through our newsletters and through the sorts of events that we choose to do.
And the tasting room too. You know, anytime anybody comes to the tasting room, I always get feedback if I send someone to you that they say it was such a great education and we felt welcome. And it's not just pretty, but it's also very friendly, and they walk away feeling like they learned something, which is more than most, right?
And again, we've tried to implement that kind of educational philosophy throughout all of the things that we do, because we feel like it's really important. I did feel like maybe we were a good winery to try to destigmatize the box. And so I wrote a blog about the decision that we were making to try to do this, talked about, yes, there are these huge environmental and sustainability benefits, but also this is a good thing for you as a customer because A, the wine, like you can open a box, have it in your fridge for months and it stays good because the oxygen never comes in contact with the wine once you've opened it. It's good in terms of portability because a box that has essentially four bottles of wine in it weighs 7 pounds. Instead of in bottles, it would weigh 11 or 12 pounds. It doesn't require all of the extra packaging to cushion the bottles because it's not fragile. It's like there's these benefits in terms of storage and footprint and transport. I was expecting it to be a moderate success. I was hoping that we would sell out of the first batch of 350 boxes that we made of our Patelin Rosé in like a month.
You also priced it really well, though. The price was attractive, even though it was the most expensive box ever. And that's, again, this is the media, right? The media says, this is the most expensive box ever. But it was very well priced if you actually broke it down by bottle. And so, yeah. Again, they're focused on the wrong part of the story, which is that actually what they should have been saying was, yeah, maybe that's true, but actually by bottle, it's a great value and it will last a really long time. And this is the future. I read your post. Of course, I follow you. And then when I saw what came out, I was like, they just completely missed what happened here.
Yeah, I mean, we felt like it was appropriate because it is less expensive for us as a winery because, I mean, the bottles and the capsules and the corks and the labels, I mean, they don't come without cost.
Right.
And so we passed along that savings to people. So instead of having...
Well, and they figured it out.
$48 each, like we did the box at $95, which is like $23 a bottle equivalent.
Right. Consumers, unlike what most of the industry thinks, they are not dummies. People in the industry think consumers are so stupid that they're not going to figure that out. But obviously, they're ahead of where others are. And I think it's fascinating that you're saying that distributors don't want the box. Sorry to jump ahead on the story, because they just keep missing it. They keep missing it over and over again because this, of course they would buy the box. They would buy the box. As in fine wine stores, absolutely. And you're not distributed in Kroger. So, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, so I felt like at least in this first go round that we should reach out to the audience that we already had who trusted us. And the response that I got was unbelievable. I mean, we sold out of that first release in 4 hours.
Oh my God.
And then I spent the next week fielding disappointed emails and phone calls from people saying, but I wasn't sitting at my computer when you announced it and it's gone. So we made a second batch of the rosé and that went fast too. We made a batch of the white a little later in the summer and we actually got our quantities more or less right. And that sold out in about a month, which is sort of what our goal was. Next week, we're going to release the boxes of the Patelin Red. For us, it's not designed to replace the bottles. It's designed to complement the bottles. It's another option for people who are going to be drinking it in the fairly near term. Because I think that's important to note that the shelf life of an unopened box is not infinite. It's not as long as a bottle. So the shelf life of an unopened box is like 6 to 12 months.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's been an encouraging first step into this particular world. And I don't know that boxes are ultimately the solution. I don't think they are the solution, but I think they're a part of a move towards something which is a lower footprint for a pretty wide swath of wines that are meant to be consumed in the relatively near term.
What about the bladder and the nozzle being made out of plastic? Does that bother you at all?
Yeah, I don't love that.
Yeah, I figured that. That's always the thing that kind of gets me. You solve the problem that also gets me, which is the coated cardboard sometimes cannot be recycled. So when you see like some of the large brands, which I will not mention their names, they coat that plastic. It's some of that stuff cannot be recycled. They have to just throw it in the landfill. Yours is biodegradable, right? The cardboard.
Yeah, we've moved entirely in our packaging, both for cases and for the boxes, the box wines themselves, to just the craft cardboard with a biodegradable ink printed on them.
It's really important, though, because I think that's where boxes go terribly wrong. If you do a bunch of stuff to a box, it's no longer easily recyclable. And then you have, in addition to that, the plastic bladder. And
the thing about the plastic bladder and nozzle inside the box, I'm hopeful if more people with higher end wines start looking at this as a package that's viable, that there will become more easily recyclable or better alternatives for what goes into it. But at the moment, everybody thinks of glass as this wonderful recyclable product, but the United States is lousy at recycling glass. Only about 30% of the glass that gets sold in the United States gets recycled. And a big chunk of that doesn't actually make it into new bottles. It gets crushed up and becomes road base.
Well, it's still better than nothing, but yes, it's true. So, you know, my friend, Karen McNamara, who is trying to think, what do you think about reuse in her program? I mean, I know it's a, she's got a lot of logistics to come up with, but what about that idea and the idea, or maybe the idea of you're already doing the kegs, so maybe bulk shipping wine to the East Coast and refilling your bottles or something, or another kind of bottle. What, have you thought about that at all?
We haven't thought about that seriously, just because the challenges of making sure that wine in bulk gets in good shape across the country, like it requires a larger operation than we are.
Right.
But I do think that you're already starting to see it with a lot of wines coming from Europe and from South America, and where it makes sense, you can fill up an entire tanker or something with a particular wine. You can temperature control it and you can bottle it closer to destination. I think that's...
They have those huge bladders now that are essentially like the bag and box where they stack the bladders on top of each other. It's amazing.
Yeah, I've seen them. They look like some... like
space age.
They do. They look like a visit from some post-apocalyptic future of like all of your nutrients will arrive by a giant bag. Like, but I do think what Karen's doing for Conscious Container, like I think that's also a part of the solution. There are wines that really should be packaged in glass. And glass is something that can be reused lots of times. And it's just that we don't have the infrastructure to get it back to the source of where it's filled, nor do we really have the infrastructure to clean off things like labels and capsules and screw caps and all of these things right now. And we've got so much diversity in bottle shapes and sizes.
That's the biggest thing that she's saying. It's that you can get people to use different papers, but until you can decide on a bottle shape, like the standard bottle shapes, it's going to be a lot harder. But yep. I love the idea.
I love the idea too.
Yeah.
And I think ultimately the solution to wine's packaging challenges is going to be a combination of approaches. I think it's going to be things like reusable packages for the appropriate things. I do think that wine in keg is such a huge leap forward for wine by the glass, because it's like you don't end up with these oxidized ends of bottles. You don't have all of the waste of that wine that doesn't get used at the end of 2 days. It gets poured out. You don't end up with all of the packaging waste.
I just love the idea, though, that you could sell it and people could fill up their own bottles. You know what I mean? At some point and charge by like they do in Europe, or they used to do in Europe. I think
used that to do in the United States, too.
It's such a great idea. What other creative solutions to solve transport, recycling, reuse, packaging? I mean, you're thinking about this all the time. This is your thing. And what do we do about the wholesalers who I know you rely on somewhat? They're just so behind and they don't seem to understand the consumers. The other problem that I think is going on here is you're a mid-sized winery. And so you have more resources than some of the smaller wineries who feel a lot of frustration that they would love to be doing the things that you do, but they don't even know how to do like some of the incremental things. How do we get this standardized so that somebody who's making 5,000 cases of wine can do some of the things that you're doing. There's no resource sharing programs. You know, what if you wanted to have sheep in the vineyard and you could switch them out? There's nothing like that. I mean, how does that resource get solved? And then also on the other end, how do we let wineries know that consumers are not dum-dums like they think we are?
I don't know. I don't know any winery that thinks the consumers are dum-dums, but I think there's two pieces to it. One is that I think there actually are some pretty compelling resources for information sharing among the wine community. So whether that is things like the regional associations, like ours is the Paso Robles Wine Country Alliance, they hold 30 plus educational events for their members, covering everything from winemaking and viticulture to marketing and accounting and HR. I mean, they have these programs.
But they don't, all the other regions don't have a U. So you are doing things that are very bleeding edge. And there are some people that are doing that in other regions, but they're not very willing to share that idea with, I mean, I'm thinking of, there's a few in Napa that just, they do it. And definitely John Williams at Frog's Leap has done more than anybody in Napa to try to spread that. But it feels like some of these places are so siloed. I mean, I even think Sonoma, so siloed that they're all doing their own thing. Paso is a very unique community. You know that. You are a very tight region. You're very close to each other.
Honestly, I think other regions do too. I mean, the business operations may be siloed, but I don't think that the viticulture side of things, I think the grape growing side of things is much less so. But it's not like this has to happen only with regional associations. There are also things like some of the sustainability certifications actually have a really important role to play in this. Somebody like the Vineyard Team that does the SIP certified program that I've criticized a bunch of times for its lack of rigor, but they have an incredible reach because so many of the wineries are in the whole Central Coast are all a part of this program. They hold educational things and their goals are terrific. I think that those sorts of sustainability certifiers have an important educational dissemination role to play. I think there are other nonprofits, things like the CCOF, which is has now become licensed with the Regenerative Organic to do regenerative organic certifications. I think they have a really important role to play. We've hosted dry farming workshops here with a nonprofit called CAFF, which is the California Alliance of Family Farmers. I think there are lots of educational opportunities within the wine community. I think we need to, those of us who are involved in these sorts of things need to be pushing the organizations that we have relationships with to have more of those things focusing on these sustainability, big picture sustainability topics, small s sustainability, right, but like big picture topics.
Right.
In terms of how we translate that out to customers, it's a combination of things. It's obviously us talking about, not us, Tablas Creek, but us wineries talking about the changes that we're making to the audience that we have. And then what happens is those consumers, then they sort of come around and they inform the restaurants and the retailers who they patronize, that it comes from the producers to the consumers. And then the people in the middle find out about it from both ends. It filters like from consumers and wineries to restaurants and retailers and eventually to wholesalers. And I agree that they are usually the last to do it because they're reactive, not proactive and things like this.
Yes. The connection between producers and consumers is invaluable. That's why direct to consumer, I think, is so very important, because that's the feedback loop for producers to know that, hey, consumers are ready. They're waiting. They want new solutions. But the problem is they're not always available because the wine industry is so slow and so conservative that it becomes a big problem. So, all right, as the last thing, what is the next thing for you guys and how can you keep moving the ball forward?
I still think that there are real package and delivery things are going to remain a focus for a long time. I know something that we've done for our wine club over the last 5 years or so, which I'd like to figure out a model to continue to build on, is one of the big sources of carbon output for small to medium-sized wineries is the air freight of bottles to their customers. I mean, if you have to send wine 6 and 12 bottles at a time by UPS and FedEx air, it's like, it's a horrifying amount of energy that you're using to do that.
It's also unnecessary cost, right? I mean, it's a huge cost to you.
And it's expensive. It's but very it's expensive. Expensive in lots of different ways.
Right.
And so what we've started doing is working to truck our wine in its original cases to staging warehouses in the Midwest and on the East Coast, from where it can be sent by ground within a day or two to our customers, instead of having to send it by air from California or send it by ground from California and have it sit in transit for 6 days, because that's not good either.
Nope.
So I think those sorts of, like, they're really not sexy at all, but those sorts of
logistics,
the logistics intersection, yes, are a place where there can be a lot of solutions. Mm-hmm. How you figure out how to mitigate the impact of glass bottles. I think a lot of the problem with glass bottles is that they're made using dirty energy. Mm-hmm. They're generally not made in places where there's a ton of renewable energy used. So that footprint will be lessened a lot as new renewable energy sources of production come online. I know that's one of the things that the IWCA, the International Wineries for Climate Action group, is working on. How do you leverage the power of all of these wineries who are almost all small and working independently? How do you get the power that they have together to make changes in the supply chain for how the raw materials get made?
It's so important, because the power of the small, I mean, we always think about the large wineries and how influential they are, but in the world, the small wineries are the majority of people making wine. And if they demand change, then change will happen, you know, yep. That. And then also consumers can have a part too, but I don't know how. I was joking around about wineries thinking that consumers are dum-dums, but my point is that because of the distribution network, people forget who's on the other end of the bottle frequently. And without that person on the other end of the bottle, you have no business. But I think that oftentimes they just think, okay, I've got to sell this to the wholesaler. The distributor needs the wine and that's it. And then once I sell it to the distributor, it's done. But that, it's not the right...
Not the right approach.
No, just because that's how the government set it up in the 1930s, that does not mean that is actually how the business works. It works like any other business, whereas if people don't buy what's on the other end, you're done. And so, again, that's why I think small producers oftentimes have a better pulse, because they're in touch with consumers constantly about what we're willing to do and what we're... And it's true that the smaller producers, mid to small producers, have much more of an idea of how to solve these problems if they all got together.
I'm encouraged by the role that wine media is playing now in a way more than I really ever have been. If you think of like somebody as influential as Jancis Robinson now commenting on bottle weight, measuring and actually commenting on every review that she writes, she talks about the weight of the
bottle. That's right.
Or the focus that somebody like Dave McIntyre has on sustainability topics. So, and I include you in this, the gatekeepers between producers and consumers have a really important role to play in kind of raising people's awareness of these bigger picture issues around wine. It's not just that wine X tastes like blackberries and dark chocolate. It's like there's so much more to the world of wine and the implications of people's buying decisions than I think most consumers have been aware of up until now. And that's changing. And it's changing thanks to some work on the part of wineries, but also a lot of work on the part of journalists talking about these issues in a way that they've never really been talked about before.
Well, I have to also say, and of course, you know, I'm obsessed with my audience and love them like family. It's push-pull. I mean, they're interested in these topics. I don't cover stuff out of nowhere. I get people ask me, hey, can you have a climatologist on? Can you talk about packaging? This is not just me alone. I do think about these issues. You know, I'm very, very environmentally conscious. It's very important to me as a value that I hold. However, if no one was interested in it, I might hold it privately. But I'm telling you, especially in like my patron community, they are so interested. I poll them regularly. Like, what do you guys want to hear about? And I'm telling you that this is very important to people. It's on their minds. When they think about their bottles of wine, they're looking at what people are doing. They look at stupid closures and they look at marketing gimmicks, and they know that they're being fleeced in some ways, and they do not like that. People are writing about it and people are concerned about it, not just as a push out thing, but at least for me, it's also pull. It's that this is what people are interested in. And that is the most encouraging thing I can possibly say to you and to any other producer who's thinking about doing this. They care, they're watching you, and they're excited about what you're doing. And all you have to do is look at how quickly your box sold out to know that. And that's exciting.
It's super exciting. That reminds me of when we were thinking about moving to lighter bottles back in 2009 or whenever it was. And we posted on our Facebook page and wrote a blog about it and sent an email out to our mailing list and said, essentially, like, what do you look for in bottles? Like, here's sort of what we're thinking about. What are you looking for? And like, we were expecting it to split fairly evenly between like, I look for this like solid substantive package. I want the wine to look serious. And people saying, please do something which is environmentally friendlier. And instead, 80% of the responses we got were, please just give me something that fits in my wine rack. So our lens in thinking about this was totally shifted by talking to our customers. Our customers are not worried about that exactly. They want something which is convenient, that is lower impact, and go from there.
Ultimately, what they want is they don't want you to change what's in that bottle, which is right. What the box just told you. As long as what you're putting in whatever vessel it is what Tobless Creek makes, which is consistent and delicious, and but has some vintage variation and is interesting, and you know, you do such a great job of educating. As long as you and every other winery who makes quality wine continues to put that in, I don't know that people really give a crap that much about, again, it does have to fit in the wine rack because it is kind of, you know, when you get a really big bottle, it's a nightmare. It's got to be practical, but I think that it's all about the juice. At a certain level, the level you're at, that's all people really care about. I think they care about that you continue to make the wine that is delicious, that they like, and that they've come to expect. You've been around for over 30 years, you know, track record speaks for itself, right?
And I think one of the things that we haven't really talked about, but I think is such an important piece of a lot of these sustainability questions is, since we really moved to farming regeneratively, which I think of as being, at least from a soil health perspective, when we were farming the whole vineyard biodynamically and got the flock large enough that we could get them through the whole vineyard every winter, which was 2016. I think we've been on the best run of quality that we have ever seen. I think these vintages, 2016 through 2021, which were a range of like drought years, wet years, hot years, cool years, uneven years, frost years, I think that run of quality that we've been on in those 6 years is unmatched in our history. And I don't think that's a coincidence. I think that the things that we're doing in the vineyard, which we think are the right things for the soil, the right things for the long-term health of the vine, have also made grapes that have more character and more intensity and more focus. That comes through in the wines that we make. And ultimately, it's not a choice between doing things in the right way for the environment and doing things in the right way to make the best wine that we can. The choices that we're making in terms of farming for the future are also the right choices in terms of making great wine in the present. And that, I think, is a really important thing for producers to realize, is that all of these investments that you're making in the long-term health of your soils and your vines, they're going to show up right away in the grapes and in the wines that you make.
And that, again, is what people care about, because people that are going to buy your wines know wine, and they know what tastes good. And they know when year after year, they're seeing really great stuff come out of Tobless Creek every year. It's just spectacular wine. This is such a great conversation. Thank you so much for your time. I admire you so much for just really following your principles and then also having a business mind about it. Because I think that's another thing. We didn't really discuss that. But, you know, you're not throwing away money. You're still concerned about making sure that the investments are wise. And I just think all of this is so very important. I wish that we could broadcast this conversation to a lot of smaller wineries who could benefit from understanding that these investments are really important, and that longer term, all of these things help. Relationships with your customers, relationships with your staff, relationships with your community, taking care of the land, all of these things in the long run it sounds like it's a lot to handle, but the more that you do it, the better off you are. So thank you, Jason.
You're super welcome. I mean, other wineries who know us know that we're an open book. I mean, if they are listening, or if they patronize wineries who are listening, and somebody is curious about, like, how do I do regenerative farming? How do I look at alternative packaging? How do I organize my supply chain in a way that hopefully has a lower impact? Like, we're happy to share everything that we've learned. So if people want to reach out to me or reach out to us here at Tablas Creek, we're always, always happy to help.
That is amazing. Thank you again. And obviously you'll be on again, because whatever the next thing is will be incredible. And we will just keep following you. You are fantastic. I can't wait to come see you again. And with that, this has been another episode of Wine for Normal People. Thank you so much for listening, and we will catch you next time.
Thanks, Elizabeth.